fact when you're making dress shoes is that people think they're kind of, I don't know, especially in England, if you're buying shoes from a fifth generation factory in England, they must be very posh. You must wear the correct shoe for it. That's not what I want. I want someone to go, that is really well bloody made. Like, that's flipping amazing.
ShoeCast. Welcome back once more to the Stitch Down ShoeCast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things we love about it. I'm Ben from StitchDown.com, and today I'm chatting with Chris Woodford, a Northampton, England, born and bred fifth generation shoemaker behind Crown Northampton. And I sure hope we can reveal it at this point, since I'm going to ask him about it nonstop, and I've been waiting literal years to do this. His new handwelt line, E. Woodford and Sons. We're going to get deep into how Crown makes some of the world's best and most interesting sneakers out of Horween Shell Cordovan and some bonkers guts, how that crazy idea all got started in the first place, what he's seen shift in Northampton over the course of his life there, and what to expect from E. Woodford. But first, we need to give a big old shout out to our sponsor this week, Grant Stone. Quite literally, nobody does widths better or deeper than Grant Stone. Go see what they've got in your size at grantstoneshoes.com. Also, here's where we urge you to join our Discord community and support this podcast you claim to enjoy. By becoming a member of Stitchdown Premium, you'll get access to brand discounts, the best sizing advice in the game, our brand new no-fee marketplace, which is good, like really good. And it's without question the best way to get in really deep with the community we're building before this October's boot camp event in New York City, which you'll be hearing plenty more about in the second half of this episode. More info on SDP and boot camp on stitchdown.com. All right, let's do this. Chris Woodford of Crown Northampton, and now E. Woodford and Sons, welcome to the ShoeCast. How are you doing, and what are you wearing on your feet today?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. Good question. What am I wearing on my feet? I'm wearing some Buffalo trainers, Buffalo sneakers, yeah. Although I do sometimes wander around barefoot when it's too hot.
I think that's okay. It's your place.
Yeah, as long as I avoid the tacks and stuff on the floor, that's okay.
Yeah, be careful, Chris. We need you. We obviously need to get into everything you're making in Northampton today and where all that's going. But I feel like there's no way to detach the Crown and E. Woodford stories really from the story of Northampton, England itself, especially given how many generations your family has been making shoes of one kind or another there. And yeah, I'd love to throw it just way back, if you don't mind.
Shoes starting in Northampton, kind of like it goes back to 1200s, where they were making like pointy shoes with like grass in the toes and just like what you like when people needed their feet really long. I don't know why they needed their feet really long, but that's what they did here in 1200.
What was the grass?
I don't know. It's like grass or hemp or something just to keep the structure of the shoe. And then in like 1400, there was a guild set up, and this had something to do with, I believe, like Cromwell's army was involved. And there's always been shoes made here for wars and armies for the Second World War, First World War, but I'll get into that a bit more with my family. That's kind of how shoe making began in Northampton, but also there's a river that runs through it. So the tanneries were here. It's the center of the country. So everything could be sent out every which way. That's the history as far as Northampton when it began. But my family actually, began their shoe trade in London, in Cold Harbour Lane, in Brixton. And that was by my great-great-grandfather. He was born in 1860. He trained in a few things, but learned shoemaking at the turn of the century. And in 1908, he opened his own shop. And I suppose back in those days, in like Edwardian England, man, it's really weird. So I'm having to look back at my history to kind of understand why my family have done what they've done, but also who does that really? Who really? When was the last time you looked back at what your great great granddad did?
I can't go that far back.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I have to do it. Well, I've got a picture of it, but I have to do it in order to kind of understand what I'm doing now. And so he started a shop in London called E. Woodford and Sons, and he made bespoke stuff. So that was kind of the start in 1908, and he opened a second store with his son in 1910, and then they carried on making through the First World War. I believe that my great-grandfather was injured but had to come home and carried on making. There are I'm trying to find footage and film or images of Brixton when it was bombed in the First World War, just to show how kind of crazy time must have been back then. And I've been writing this history, and I found lots of old books and things. And it's bits of it were quite hard because I wanted to write it all myself, especially for the website, to make it look as like what needs to be genuine, because everything we're trying to do is genuine. But then as I was writing it, I was kind of like, my granddad, so third generation, he was meant to take over in 1939. And 1939 is when the Second World War started. And firstly, when that started, he couldn't get leather, or my family couldn't get leather at the time, because it was all being shipped to Northampton, because that's where they made war boots. And they were taking all the leather and materials required, because it was just that was the most important, just survival, what we all cared about, I suppose, back then. And also the other reason is that he was conscripted, so he had to go to war. And then I found, like, I knew he'd ended up in Dunkirk, which is crazy, but I found an old diary. I was given an old diary by my dad, and he's got like a postcard of his, like, he was really detailed. So he had like a key at the bottom of what happened on which day and where he went through France. And like, there's a little symbol for when he was bombed, and there's a symbol for when he ended up here, and he ended up in Dunkirk. And that's like, those stories are not like, that's just a different world, man. It's just like, most people don't really look at their past like that, but I had to kind of stop writing it and then sort of note down what I could, and then get a copywriter to make it a little less personal, because I had to like stop writing and go, that's a bit heavy for me. Because I was hearing stories of like, he was one of the last on the beach, and there were guys with bayonets stopping people storm the boats, and just like, you get a tag like that has a number on it that just says, this is the number for you to get on a boat to get off the beach that's getting bombed and planes flying over. And he had a bit of a premonition with some friends to get off the lorry he was on, and it was blown up, and he had to horribly just like sort through bodies to find a lower tag number so that he could get off the beach quicker, because obviously the dead people aren't getting off the beach. And that kind of stuff, like, it's weird to think that those stories kind of are important with what I do now. But as I was sort of going through it, I was like, oh, maybe that explains why I'm so stubborn and just so kind of, I'm just driven. Because you kind of, it's just that you are who you are because of your past, aren't you, I suppose, and your DNA. I suppose that explains a bit about why I'm doing what I'm doing now. So that's kind of that part of my history. He ended up in hospital for a good few years after war. And his son was born, like loads of sons and daughters were born after the Second World War, 1946. I bet loads of people have that birthday. So my father, he was trained in like work study, but the factories, the shops that we were running in London, they were shut because they couldn't get the leather, and because my granddad was ill, I suppose, after going to war. And so my father did a work study thing in London, and then moved to Northampton just out of random choice, just moved to Northampton. And his first job was working in a company that owned two shoe factories, because Northampton was making thousands of pairs of boots during the war, probably millions of pairs. So the whole town, all its kind of history, all the staff that I now employ are like third or fourth generation, but it's because of wars and because of you have an industry set up, it's how you keep that going. And that's been like the rise and fall of Northampton. It's a load of reasons why Northampton sometimes just does well and sometimes does badly. But unless you kind of adapt and focus on how you can make it work, because you've got all the skilled staff here, it's just trying to keep them employed. But anyway, my father moved here in the 70s, and his job was to amalgamate a cement construction factory with a welded factory. And that was what he did for, I can't remember the name of the company, I've got it written down. It'll be on our website for our history. But he did that for a bit, and he observed it, and then he set up on his own making moccasins and cement constructed footwear and stuff. Back then it was still like most stuff made was going to UK department stores. There wasn't like this influx of cheaper product, I suppose, or cheaper ways of getting product from like China and India. And he grew really quickly, too quickly, I think, or he now says, but what do you know at the time? Like this, again, the past again is reflected how I run a business now, which you'll find out later, but when you start work and what you're taught to do is get as big as you can, I suppose, and make as much money as you can, which is how it, I suppose, it used to be. It's not really like, it's not, definitely not that for me now, but back in the day, it was, he just grew and he took on orders. So he needed more staff and the staff were already here. So he grew. And he, after like 2 years, he said he had 250 staff and three big factories and making hundreds of thousands of pairs and £5 million turnover in like the 70s, which is great. And I understand. And I imagine the buzz he must have got. It was weird. I never saw him. Like when I was little, I'm like, because all he did was work. But that's not through really his choice. It's what happens when you build something that's so big, so quick. You've got to control it somehow. But also, he was utterly reliant on mass-produced stuff and utterly reliant on department stores. And department stores are utterly reliant on who's selling the same thing cheaper down the road back in those days. So my dad just said, as soon as the work sort of left for a week and you've got a few, couple hundred staff with no work, it doesn't last long. Your cash flow soon disappears. And it just shuts. So I have really early memories of walking around these big factories and going, this place smells amazing, really cool. And then distinct memories of it all just going and like how hard that was, not just like for my family, but like for all the people that were employed there. I meet people now that were in the shoe trade 30 or 40 years ago. Weirdly, someone that I bought a unit off over the road to me, they were in the shoe trade. There's about 70 and they were in the shoe trade and they worked for the British Shoe Corporation. And they remember going and making 200 people redundant because there was just no work. That's just how it was back in the day.
Yeah. I mean, and we visited your factory, among others, with a group about a month ago. And on, I guess, the first day we were there in the afternoon, we did a little, this used to be a shoe factory, Northampton walking tour with Michael James of Springline, the last maker. And until then, we didn't realize that we'd been walking past buildings that used to be shoe factories on literally every single block and kind of figured out how to spot them thanks to Michael. And it was, you know, they become flats or offices or just homes or, I mean, who even knows? It really was crazy. I mean, like the book that he had was thick and it was both wonderful. I mean, it was incredibly historic and, you know, just a really interesting, the original Edward Green factory, like just this tiny little house, basically. And of course, you're contrasting that with, man, like what this used to be. And, you know, it all just kind of, not all of it, obviously, but a huge percentage of it just kind of drifted away, like pretty much starting in the 80s, right?
If 80% of your town are employed to do one thing, they've got to keep finding that work. And there's a load of things that need to be in place for that to work. The people that are buying it need to want to buy it from and pay the price that it costs from that area. And the people that are making it in that area need to have confidence. Like I've got real confidence now of making stuff in Northampton. You just have to find a way of doing it. But it's a shame. A lot of companies, I suppose, just try and survive. So if they can't see a way of selling stuff and they want to sell volume, lots of brands have to just import stuff. Or import parts of the shoe and put it together here. But I understand how that happens. There's loads of like, if you're selling a shoe at a price point and it's known throughout the market, throughout the world at that price point, it's you've got to keep it like that. And the only way to do that sometimes is to import components because they've still got to sell it, you know, because they've still got all the staff to employ here somehow, keep a business going. It's not like how I run my business, but I understand how it happened and how businesses just got lost. And how hard that there's another thing, and it's just generally true. The shoe trade is pretty tough. It's pretty hard work. And I'm not sure it's as viable now for guys leaving school to go, actually, what I want to do is go and stand at a machine. If it's mass produced stuff, I don't mean mass, like hundreds of thousands of pairs. But I mean, if you go into even to a welded factory and you're a really good welt sewer, you're going to do that forever. And that's good. If you can find someone that can do it, but I think that's a really difficult pool of people to choose from. Whereas if you're back, I don't know, 60 years, you've got hundreds of people that are looking for work. And that's what kept it going. It's just, you have to, I'll get onto this later, but it's why I'm trying to create an academy and it's why I'm trying to create handmade stuff. It's just because you get a career and people want careers in something that has heritage. And that's kind of what I'm all about. So yeah, I'm kind of nothing like how my father ran a business, but that's because his background was work study and how to make stuff at a price point and how to sell it. And that's what business is if you're not involved in it. Whereas, so I started Well, he started again here in the unit next door to where I'm sitting now with two machinists. He carried on going to a couple of customers he had making moccasins and things and like specialist stuff like race boots and boxing boots and like loads of unique stuff. I kind of wanted to be involved in the industry when I was leaving school, but I didn't want to be reliant because of what I'd observed and what we've been talking about. I didn't want to rely on other people, whether they liked something I was doing or their brand. So the first thing I did was learn pattern cutting and design, which gives me control of what I'm making. I'm no longer going, this is all I've got. How do I sell it? I'm going, this is what I've got, but I can literally design anything to suit a market. I made for a few other people for a while, and then I got lucky enough to create a brand called Crown, which was picked up by a distributor in Asia. And that was kind of the first stage of growth for us. So I had that lovely control of having my own brand. I wasn't making stuff that I particularly would design, but it was nice to fly somewhere in the world and go, what is it you want? And I'll make it for you. As long as it sits within my brand, within my styling. That's that business that I suppose most people that are trying to mass produce stuff aim for, is get it in the best stores in the world. And that was kind of what I aimed to do, my own stuff on shelves, designed by us, made here by us. That's why actually, particularly the Japanese like our stuff, and like most of the factories that are left in Northampton, there's probably nine of us left now. But when it was thousands, that's sad, isn't it? But that's just how it is. And that was the first kind of security that I had.
And that was these, like the jazz shoes, right? Like these incredibly lightweight shoes beloved by people in Japan.
Yeah, like really minimal kind of, started out as a jazz shoe. And then I just probably did 20 new designs a year for chains of stores in Japan. And that's really cool because it's kind of made in England for another market. It's quite difficult for people to copy that, which is, I suppose, important. But I thought at the time that was kind of what I wanted. I thought I'd wanted to see my shoes like on a shelf in Isetan, for example, in Japan, like the best department store in the world, or one of them. And I did it. And I got in there and I remember walking around the corner going, yes, that's not the feeling I wanted at all. All I felt was like there's some shoes on a shelf. It's nice that I've got people employed here to make them, but it gives you other worries like, how do I keep them there? I hope they sell through, and all the other things that go through your head when you're running a business that relies on other people. And then that's when I kind of came to the conclusion, perhaps now I'm in a good position to start my own brand online direct to consumer. I suppose someone asked me a couple of weeks or a month or two ago why I decided to do this, like why sell stuff direct to people using the materials I do, and we'll talk about that in a sec. I think definitely I'm trying to find job security, but I'm also trying to find, I'm 16 years old, standing at a press still in my head going, how can I make this like a nice place to be? Because I don't want it to be like a factory. I want it to be like a place I go to work where I'm not just standing doing something. I feel part of something. That's the way I can do it. That's the way. But I said, like, it's much better to have 10,000 individual customers that understand what you're saying and like what you're doing and can get why it is you're doing it. I had the security of creating a site, and if I sold one, I could put it through. If I sold 10, I could put them through. That was security, basically. Like it means it didn't matter if I sold one or 10. It meant I didn't have to be pushy with sales. Imagine if you're setting up a business and you go, or a shoe company especially, and you're going, how the hell do I do that? What do I need? Where do I go? And you'd have to go to a factory, I suppose, and say, well, I need investment to buy this amount of stuff, and this is where I've got to sell it, and this is da-da-da-da, and all those things cost. Whereas I had a wall and running, so I didn't need the investment in that side, so I didn't have that cash flow issue. I didn't have that demand on my shoulders to sell stuff. But what it did do was allow me to talk about the staff and why they're important and why Northampton's important.
In terms of, you know, these sneakers and trainers, I mean, they're for real. I have a pair, Color 4 shell. They're fabulous. They're different, right? Like they're actually somewhere in terms of, you know, what's inside them, not necessarily like what they look like or the outsole or anything. You know, they're this interesting hybrid of a quote unquote real shoe and a sneaker.
My background is more the traditional shoemaking. So at college, I learned like hand welting, hand lasting, materials matter, how to make something really, really nice. And I suppose even if I'm making a trainer, I want that to be the best trainer I can possibly make. So the first trainers I made were like, let's make them at a price point that people can hopefully kind of afford. It's always going to be expensive because employing people in Northampton is going to be expensive. And I'm always going to use the best materials. So I use the same tanneries as like Crockett and Jones, for example, in Northampton, or Church's. We all use the same tanneries, really, for a sneaker that I could hopefully sell at a price point like under £300, or in the US it's less than that, I suppose. Yeah, so that worked quite well, and it sold quite well. But then I thought, that's working. Let's design something like without worrying about the price, because I'm not putting on massive margins. So like, I'm not doing the wholesale channel. I understand the wholesale channel. I do it in like my wholesale business, but I don't want to make something and then the customer pay, I don't know, 5 or 6 times what it's worth. Or if it's a really high end brand, 50 times what it costs to make. So I designed stuff that using cordovan, thinking that's kind of the best leather I can find. And I thought, well, what's the best kind of lining that will suit that? So I selected a veg tan calf that's used. I think the only other people who use it are like really posh brands in France for their handbags, for the handles of their handbags. And so I'm going to show you, not that the whole world can see that, but that's like a black marble horween, because that's the other thing. There are lots of companies that make lots of different leathers. And if I say cordovan, there's lots of places that make cordovan. I've got Japanese cordovan here, which is quite nice, but the horween cordovan, just generally from a hand lasting perspective, and it's just the best. So that's a note for people. They're looking to buy cordovan, look for horween cordovan. It just generally does work the best. It's really difficult to work with. This is another thing that's a bit mad about me. I tend to use materials, and you'll see this a lot more in my eWoodford shoes, I'll show you in a bit, that imagine you go to a factory and go, here's some leather, and it's like really difficult to cut, it's really expensive, and you're going to have to throw a bit of it away, and it's not really cost viable. That's the leather I want to use. That's the stuff I want, because it's unique. And that's why I've ended up with cordovan and buffalo. That's like buffalo is difficult to work with, but it's cool stuff. Or Scottish deer. And I line it with veg tan, which is kind of the nicest veg tan I could find. And this is where, what you were talking about in regards to the materials inside the shoe that you can't really see on the outside. This is definitely dress shoe. My background in dress shoes is that the toe puff and the stiffener are oak bark tanned. And it's done in Devon in a tannery called Baker's, which is like 500 years old, which we've been to film recently for E. Woodford. That really is amazing, that the way that leather's made and how long it takes to make, to the extent where, like, do you want to hear a bit about oak bark tanned leather?
Yes.
Okay. So we went to film there, but whilst we were there, he was putting English calf in through pits of water, and he explained the process of how they go from one station to the next. And it takes about a year moving from one station to the next, and it's just English calf with oak bark. He can't actually explain how the chemical reaction occurs to make the leather as good as it is. But in fact, I asked him, how do you know what you're doing? And he said, well, my family bought it like 180 years ago. I was like, yeah, but how do they know what they're doing? He's like, well, it's been here for 500 years. I was like, okay.
Just did the same thing.
Yeah. So I'll take his word for it, but it is generally. And I suppose time tells you whether something is that good. And if it's still here, and they're still saying the same thing, then I've got to go with it. But anyway, so I filmed all that process. So it's taken out of the pits after a year, and it's all hand finished and hand rolled. And so that's like a year and a half in the tannery. And I'm like, that's really cool. And then I noticed a big pile of oak bark that obviously he's going to put in with the leather. And I said, so this is the stuff you're going to use? And he's like, yeah, we're going to use it, but not for 3 years because it needs to dry out. Well, that's cool. So that's another 3 years to the process. He's like, hang on a minute. Where do you get the oak bark from? And he's like, one of our main providers is a guy that lives in a forest in Wales. I was like, that's cool. Right. And he's like, and it is totally sustainable oak, literally planted 20 years, grows an oak tree, cuts it by hand, strips the bark off by hand, and sends that bark to, so it's 20 years before you get the bark, and then it dries out for 3 years, and then it goes to the tannery for like a year and a half. So it's like 24 and a half years. So like the toe puff in this shoe and the stifler in this shoe is weird to think it started 24 and a half years ago or 25 years ago, but it's really cool. It's really unusual. It's really cool. And so I like using materials like that. So, and again, dress shoe underneath the oak bark, stiffeners and toe puffs. We have, a veg tan lining and a veg tan insole, which is like 3 or 4 mil thick. And underneath that, we put cork in just like a dress shoe. It's all done by hand, but it's that once you've got cork under a shoe, once you put your foot in it and you wear it for a little bit, it will mold your foot. And it should last you forever. And then at the bottom, we've got a Lactohavia sole, which a few brands use now, actually, but it's like a natural gum. It's literally from a tree and poured into a mold. And I use that because it's the best I could find. It's a nice feeling going, what's the best thing I can use for that? And then going there and then going, how much does that cost? And if they say it's like really expensive and no one's using it because it's really expensive, going, I can use that because this isn't going to be five times what it costs to make. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, the direct model helps with that. I don't know. There's something about them and yeah, just kind of like the insanity around all of this decision-making. Like you can use different stiffeners, right? Especially in the toe. Like everybody does. They'll be effective. But yeah, I mean, there's something about just the desire and ability and, you know, kind of screw looseness of like you specifically to just to go ahead and do it and then say, you know, come and get it and figure out how to price it in, you know, a competitive field where, you know, I mean, like people make these kinds of sneakers and they don't have these materials and in some instances, you know, charge more than you. So like there was actually like a neat little place to fit into just because of the overall market and how that's grown in the last, like I looked it up. I have kind of question for you on this, like 20 years, Common Projects started 20 years ago.
I'm a fifth generation shoemaker. And normally a fifth generation shoemaker is being put in a position where they've probably got loads of staff already. Like I imagine if I had 100 staff and my dad's business had never gone under and we'd never had to start again, I probably would never have learned pattern cutting and design. I should have done, but you know, I'd have probably been sent to a university where I learned how to manage people, and I probably would have known how to manage a big company. But because of circumstance, and this is what I mean by the past is relevant, is because of circumstance, just because I'm in a position where I was literally on the factory floor on less than minimum wage learning how to make stuff, it just changes your mindset. So I feel much more genuine selling something to people that is really the best you can make. And even though it's expensive, it's like justifiably expensive. And I don't think I could sell something that costs a quarter of the price and sell it for this price point, because I just couldn't justify it to myself. And I want people to walk in here and go, I want those because they're the best. I think if I was more money or business orientated, I'd create a different thing. But because I want to create something that's really nice and money isn't a driver for it, it creates something different. Does that make sense?
It does. And yeah, I mean, you can see it in the product. Again, I don't think anybody else would have kind of landed where you did, or they would have been priced at, you know, this highly unobtainable price point and been a very, very small part of the business. But yeah, I think where it all ended up, it's something that people can actually get behind too. And, you know, once they understand it, a lot of these shoes, you know, they look similar, right? That's kind of the idea. They're very basic. So there's something else that they have to buy into, and it's not just, you know, a story, and it's certainly not just marketing or, you know, how they kind of style it with, I don't know, just pants, you know, like they're very straightforward shoes until you realize that they're not. And if that's a style that you're looking for, and that's where I think that there's this very interesting and ripe crossover between people who, you know, love shoes. Like I was talking with Ryan, our producer, earlier today. Like I bought a pair of shoes to, you know, play basketball poorly. And that's the first pair of sneakers that, other than yours, that I've, you know, kind of acquired in the last decade, basically. Because once you get into real shoes and boots, like, that becomes your life. And then,
what's a real shoe or a real boot?
I mean, you know, something that is, you know, resoleable construction, you know, welted, etc. And, you know, just feels completely differently, right? And I think that there, you offer something to that group that they can't really quite get in terms of what it feels like under your foot, even though they can get something that might look somewhat similar, minus the shell.
I certainly don't care what other people are doing. So I don't design anything to, like, I've never designed anything. I don't have the time, man. I just like making stuff here and explaining why it is I've made it, rather than going, ooh, I wonder what I could design that matches kind of a bit like that, that I could sell. That's a kind of, what's the point, man? Then you start copying, and then it's just like, you're not, it just takes away a bit. You're not, if you have to kind of be genuine. And I think people see through that if you do it. I think people, especially since Common Projects, like, designed a good looking shoe to the market, which was their aim, and it worked and it sold. And then other people went, ooh, look what they've done. Let's copy it. Whereas I like something that is comfortable on my foot and I like really nice materials and I like minimal and I like just like really well-made stuff. Like you'll see in the welted stuff, that I just want it to be the best. So
one more before we get to the break.
Yeah.
You know, dress minimalist or dress sneakers with suits. Let's hear about it, Chris.
I think that's absolutely fine. Like, who says it's not?
Derek guy.
Some guy.
Well, he is some guy. He's a menswear guy on Twitter.
Yeah, that's fine. And that could be his opinion. Just this week, I had a guy turn up in a suit and he wanted some really cool shoes that he could wear for his wedding. And I said, you could try these new welted stuff that we're doing, or you could try this sneaker that we're doing. He's like, I think I'll wear a sneaker, please. Like, okay. Who am I to tell him? Like, it's not my place, man. Like, taste is a weird thing, isn't it? Like, if we all had the same, if we all listened to what someone told us and just did it, well, there'd only be one shoe on the market. There'd only be one sneaker. And we'd all wear it. And that's it. And then when we changed our clothes, when we got out of our jeans, we put a suit on, we'd get the correct shoes for that. What's the right, like, short, like, tie to wear with it, or the right shirt to wear with it? I don't care. Like, just walk around naked for all I care. Just wear the right shoes that you like, man. Just wear something that's comfortable. Actually, I wear my shoes because you're employing people in Northampton that like what they're doing. That's the way I do.
Well, maybe, you know, yours can be an exception. But yeah, personally, I feel like it's an absolute scourge. And I like people wearing welted shoes too, you know?
Yeah.
And drifting back that way. I think that's...
Why do you think it's a scourge?
I just don't think they look quite right. You know, if everybody's wearing sneakers all the time. Like, at least in my country. And, you know, when I was over there in England, I mean, it was very heartening to see, especially in London. And we spent a lot of time around Jermyn Street and Savile Row and all that. I mean, there were people wearing real shoes, way more than you see in New York City. And I love that, you know, that, like, it made my heart beat faster in all the right ways.
Yeah. And, yeah. And again, this is what I mean by doing what other people do, what you want, man. So like, you'll get that in London and people wearing really nice or welted shoes because that's what they want to wear. A lot of people are wearing trainers because that's the current trend. You know what I mean? And that's like, just wear what you want to wear. I don't think I can judge anyone on what they're wearing on their feet.
All right, fine. We got to take a break. We'll talk about this privately. So let's do that. We'll be right back with Chris Woodford. Not everybody's feet are the same size. Did you know that? Shocking information, which makes it all the more confusing that so many shoes and boots, especially ready-to-wear options that can be at your doorstep in a couple days, come in many sizes, but only one width. It's criminal. Our feet should organize a class action lawsuit. People should probably be arrested. Grant Stone is wonderfully old school that way. They believe in the power of widths like few brands on the market, and we love them for it. Currently, Grant Stone has 48 styles, 48 that come in D, E, and triple E widths, letting just about anybody dial in a perfect fit. And come spring, their vaunted loafers, which I personally adore all year round and wear in an E-with, are going to be hitting the stock deep Triple E jackpot themselves. In a world with a criminal lack of widths, Grant Stone will certainly not be among the prosecuted. Check out their entire lineup, widths and all, at grantstoneshoes.com. And now, back to the ShoeCast. All right, we're back on the ShoeCast. Chris Woodford. So I've been waiting literal years for this. Let's finally get down to it. E. Woodford & Sons, your new handwell brand named after the original name of the company started by your great-great-grandfather. What's the story here? I saw a little bit of it out there, but this is all pretty undercover until like now, basically.
One thing leads to another, which is what I was talking about earlier. So I started with a tiny little factory. It's still pretty small, but there's more of us in it. I started with a wholesale business, and then we started the online sneaker business. And actually, this came a lot about because of the Cordovan sneakers and me designing something that's quite expensive and then not knowing whether people would actually buy it. It's like, who's going to buy a brand they don't know and pay that much money for something? But they do, and they buy a lot of the Cordovan stuff. And it works really well because people are getting what we're doing. And that gave me the confidence to go back to what I kind of really want to do, which is make proper hand-welded shoes. A similar principle to Crown Northampton, the trainers, but a totally separate business. So we now make hand-welted, hand-stitched, hand-lasted, and pretty much hand everything. Basically, I'm trying to get rid of machinery using the best materials I could possibly find, similar business model, but it's taken probably 3 years to train people. The guy that taught me at college, Len, who's, I think he's 80 now, he's in here a couple of days a week and has been for 3 years teaching guys here to hand make shoes. And it's just cool. It's just such a nice feeling. It's like surprised how little a feeling I got from seeing my original shoes in a shop in Japan. It's like the opposite for what I'm doing now. It's like when the lad 2 years ago came to me with like, look what I made, look what I hand lasted. And he was so proud of what he'd done. Like that is why I do what I do. And I was like, oh, I get it. No, that's what I need to do. More of that. So we've done more of that. So we've created loads of interesting styles based on the similar principles as the sneakers. But I can talk you through different bits of a few boots. But it's basically lovely for me because it's like full circle. It's like it's E. Woodford again. People say things like your granddad or your great great granddad would be proud. I have no idea. But what is really cool is that, like, I don't know him. What's really cool is that I've created like a little shop like he had. It's just that I now have the ability for the world to see it. So I've got a boot here. Now you guys love Cordovan. So this is, I'll put it in frame for you. So this is black Cordovan, which is you're pretty familiar with. So story of the oak bark again. Oak bark I use for pretty much everything. So for the sole, for the welt, which is really unusual. I had to, again, this comes back to being in Northampton and me finding someone that used to make welts and having all the kit that makes the welts and then me supplying them with the oak bark so that I can actually get oak bark welts because I don't know any other way of doing it. We make some ourselves for the bespoke stuff that we do, but I need a bit more than what a bespoke shoe is. So the idea is to make it something that I can employ people by doing. Like I could quite easily make bespoke shoes and make them a couple of pairs a month and sell them for a lot of money. And that's it. But that's like, as from my previous businesses, like that's not what I'm about. It's about creating jobs. It's about creating careers actually now. It's about creating careers that pay like a proper wage. That's why I've spent money, loads of money training people, getting people in to train these guys how to hand last and stuff and hand welt and hand channel. Like starting with I'll give you some technical stuff if you like.
Please.
So as you've probably been told 1,000 times, hand welted stuff or handmade stuff is best made on a wooden last. It's done so because we use loads of water in the uppers. We soak them and then we put them on the last and they get a really nice shape. So, and because of that, you can use really nice shaped last. So we use a slightly off center cone last. This is a Oxford last. And because we use so much water, when it dries out, it kind of forms the last shape really nicely. Like this has got quite a big curve to it on the inside. Normally in a mass produced, when I say mass produced, if you're in a factory in Northampton, like Trickers, they'll have machinery that pulls everything over and they're trying to make a volume. They're trying to make some of them, but the last needs to be a lot more uniformed for them to pick up and put it on a machine. Whereas if you're hand making something, it doesn't matter if the cone is slightly off and you spend time moving an upper to make sure it fits the last perfectly, then you can use pretty much whatever shape you like. So I've gone really traditional, really old school. So this was, I think, a version. So I did it at Springline, as you can tell. I've done it in collaboration with him. So we went through a few different designs and we have like a shoe last, a loafer, well, two shoe last, a loafer last, and a boot last. That's the last. And then we start using the oak bark stuff. So this is the shoulder. So depending on what part of the shoe you're talking about, depends on what part of the animal we're using. So we use the shoulder for the insole. In a factory, they, as you know, sew on a welt, not sew on a welt, cement stick or welt. You have a bit of leather, like an insole board, and you put the welt on it. Whereas we do it how it used to be done. We channel it all out by hand with a knife. And then this is slightly unique to us, I think. Somebody will tell me different, or someone will tell you different, I'm sure. So Len that came in and taught my guys how to hand last and how to do this channeling. He used to do it as a job, as piecework, like 50 years ago when there was still a trend. He needed to hit a certain target a day in order to make a certain amount of money a day. And that's just how it was. In fact, he said back in the day, if he had a day off, the owner would drive to his house and pick him up and take him in. He had like 2 days off in his life. he can't be ill in shoemaking. And he was really good at showing how to make shoes. And he did the basics really nicely. But I want kind of beyond the basics. I want the basics. I want what he taught them to be shown, which is what we're going to show. We'll come to your event. And with a couple of guys to show that. But, what I wanted to do was make them as perfect as possible. So I said to the guys, I don't mind if it takes you all day to do one of these. We're not on piecework. We'll take as long as it takes. And then whatever that is, we'll work out how many we can make a month, which is why we came to the total of 25. It's based on machinists, machining uppers that are like, well, yeah, we'll get to that as well. We'll start with this. So this is the insole. It's oak bark. So this is the shoulder. It's wet and it's put on the insole. And it's the thing you'll notice about hand lasted shoes is that you get a lovely arch support and we get all trimmed away all nicely. So it's really neat and tidy in the shoe. The other thing about oak bark tan stuff is that it's lighter. Don't know why. Look at the video when the website's up. And it's the perfect material for what we use. Going back to the upper, which is kind of important because there's a load of bespoke makers in the world. And they do, you often see a video of someone hand cutting something, which we do. We hand cut like, well, it's mainly cordovan, but we use, so the options are cordovan, buffalo from Horween, Stead's Janus calf, which we've got a couple of embosses of. I don't use calf leather like you would get for normal shoes. I use baker's calf. So I make shoes where the upper is the same leather or same supplier as the sole and everything else. Other people can't use this because if I order a skin, it takes 3 months and I'll probably get one pair out of it and it costs, I don't know, 300 quid a skin. Which if you're making stuff in any other factory is not viable. Like normal calf leather is like, I don't know, a good quality calf leather is like 10 to 12 pounds a square foot. Whereas this is like, I don't know, it's more like cordovan prices, but it's lovely. It's like the same sort of, well, it's the best I can get. It's English made, which matters because we're an English brand, I suppose. It's weird. I don't really view anything I do as like a brand. I view it as just a shoe. So it's not like I want to portray it in any way. It's just like, here it is.
I like that.
But the upper is really unusual. So this is an Oxford shoe. The bit that you don't see when someone, as I was going to say earlier, when you're seeing bespoke shoes being made, is the you see a little bit of someone machining the shoe, you know, like, oh, there it is on a machine being stitched. And I wanted that when it was required. But what I really wanted to do was hand stitch and hand punch stuff. So I want that to be as bespoke, or not bespoke, but as unique as skill set. Because the guys, my machinists are like, no, they're third or fourth generation. They've been in the trade for like, I don't want to tell you what they are, long enough to make like really cool shoes. And they're really good at their job. So we've done things like hand punch every hole in this shoe. And then back, so this is a brogue. And we punch the big holes, and then we back it with baby calf, and then we punch the little holes, and then we hand stitch in between the holes and things like that.
Yeah, we've talked about that before, where, you know, you can show it and it kind of says something about the value and what you get for the price you're paying, and, you know, the time it takes and all that. But, you know, to hear you tell it, I mean, some of these techniques and these skills, you know, you've got the guy who taught you, who's 80 years old, and he knows how to do them. And it's possible that very few, if not zero people other than him, know how. And just that knowledge transference, like, that's one of the beauties of this whole project to me, is that it's not just about making shoes. It's certainly not just about cranking them out. It's about preserving something that, you know, people, you know, you can figure out how to punch holes decently and then what to do after that. But, you know, some of this stitch work, like, you just don't see it anywhere. And that's because, one, there might not be a huge demand for it, but two, the knowledge just doesn't exist or could disappear.
Well, I was lucky. I happened to know someone who just about had the time left on this mortal coil to teach some others. But it's the same in the machining, like hand stitching a shoe, like this one, all of this shoe is hand stitched, like, from start all the way, it's all one continuous hand stitch, and it's all got some really cool features on it. But that takes, no one's going to do that in a normal factory, because it takes a day and a half to stitch the upper. Whereas it, like this boot or that brogue in a factory, you probably cost it at maybe 20 minutes. And that's fine. That those people are still highly skilled that are machining it. It's just that I want to show off a different skill set, because it's not about, especially when you're talking at a tannery that takes like 25 years to create something, it's not about time and getting it done as quickly as you can. It's just about time and making something as well as you can, like using old traditional styles. And then again, highlighting material is so, like, I don't know if you can see in this boot, but in the little back stab, I've got the reverse side of the Horween logo in the back there. That's just a little nod to the quality of the material. Yeah, it's worth talking about materials in these things, because the collars and we use a lot of Scottish red deer, because it's softer than most things that we found. It's kind of the best thing for the job in the collars. And then the lining is lined with like the finest calf I can find. So it's from a Tuscan tannery. It takes like eight. This veg tan takes, it's just like the finest calf I could find. But I use that for the lining. It's like most people would possibly use it as an upper, because it's a similar sort of price point. But that's not what it's about. That's the best thing I can find for that job. So that's what I'm using. Whatever price point it comes out at, it comes out at. And then I hope that people appreciate that. This is the sort of stuff I know you sort of like, is the handmade, the real hands-on part. So this is, we get an up or down, that's taken however long it took to machine. And then we put that on the last, and that's all done by hand. And you'll see videos of it, of us doing, you've probably seen videos of loads of people doing it in the world, but pins, penning it around, pulling it into the right spot, getting it nicely down to the wood and just looking good. And then again, because it's just the right thing to do, we use side linings in our shoes. So which makes them much stronger. So this is like my version of a World War I boot. This is the first design I did, actually. And this has, like, you don't have to do this, is a bit excessive, but I use the same really expensive calf lining as a side lining, which goes in between the lining and the upper. But when it's wet, same as everything else, and when it dries, it gives you that brilliant, like, firm. Can you hear that?
Okay.
That's the inside. That's the inside of the shoe.
Don't hurt yourself. Like,
where it's normally softer. I suppose from picking up a boot, I can just like talk for hours about each thing. But from a design perspective, this is kind of an important boot for me, because there was a boot in the museum, and it was from what it was basically called the World War One boot. That's what made Northampton, like, that's what made them mass produce stuff, and that's what's kept the part of the reason why I'm here, I suppose. So I thought I'll nod to that. That seems like I'm a tiny that without that there wouldn't be me. Without anything else, there wouldn't like be me with all the other stuff I've gone through. So I've done my version of that. So the patterns are very similar. But what I'm 100% sure about is that army boots didn't have the quarters tucked in like that and have them hand stitched to show like the skill, and also the back strip wasn't the same thing tucked in and the reverse folded at the top to show that like we're using cordovan, so it's got the little label at the top. So it's really, really expensive way of making something. Like the back strip on this costs probably £200. but it's not about that. It's just about, this is the best I could possibly make. I don't know how to make any better.
What else should people expect to see style-wise? Like when I was over there, we saw those boots, we saw some loafers, those Oxfords that you showed. I mean, it's like a pretty impressive range, honestly.
This was made on that last I was showing you a minute ago. So you can see how it's really kept the shape of the last. It's got a really unusual tone to it, like a load of depth back here. The molds that should fit real nice. But this is dead suede, and we've had it stamped, and then we hand stitch. So when you'd normally have rows of stitching, we hand stitch it, except for when it's around the top line, because I don't want hand stitching rubbing against your foot. It has to be usable, right? Things like counters, we use like kudu because it's like the best material I could possibly find for the counter, because it's like 2 mil thick, should last forever.
Interesting. Kudu for the counter, huh?
Yeah, for the counter lining. Yeah, inside the shoe.
Oh, okay, I see.
Not for the outside of the shoe. The outside of the shoe is all the same as the calf suede. And then the same for a loafer. But yeah, all are hand lasted, so all are channeled. So I suppose what isn't shown loads is literally how the stuff's put together. And this is dead interesting. You even had a go of it when you were here. But the one thing you didn't do when you were here was make a thread, because that took the guys here like months to learn how to do it properly, how to like get some hemp, pull it out, get it the amount of ply that we need. We use 9 ply or 13 ply if it's a boot. And that's the stitch we use to stitch the welt on. You didn't do that bit. And put the bristle on. It takes ages. Like there's loads of things that take ages that you could just buy a thread, but it's just not how I want this brand to sit. I just like it needs to be, if I can, handmade threads. They are handmade threads. It needs to be, if I can, the best shoulder leather that I can use for the insole. It needs to be, if I can, the set we use oak bark for the toe puff. So we use the shoulder for the toe puff, and then for the stiffener we use the same. But on the soles it's bends. But I'm sort of flicking about all over the place because my mind's you've set me off on one now. just by sitting silently. What you've done there is let me talk.
I will apologize for not making an entire shoe for you perfectly in 15 minutes after I had like a sandwich and a Moretti at like noon. But yeah, when we were out there, so the right guys come into this workshop, the very workshop that you're sitting in right now. We met Will and Lewis, and they're like, okay, yeah, here, you're going to do this now. And yeah, I mean, I put 3 stitches in a hand welt and then got that bristle through eventually from either side and yanked them and try not to slice my hands open, thanks to, Will's little leather kind of grippy thing that he put on my hand. And I mean, it was beautiful. Everybody's still talking over there about how perfect they came out and how talented I am. And then I hit myself in the face with the shoe.
That was as you were leaving. We actually threw that at you.
that was the second time. But yeah, I mean, it flew off the last thing because it's very, very difficult. And it's kind of my job to know about this stuff and understand it and help other people understand it and, talk to people and watch it happen live and watch videos and all that. And until I did it, I didn't. So much opened up, let's put it that way. And it's not just in terms of how difficult it is, which is the case, and how difficult it is to be, precise and make it look beautiful, but just like the physical work behind it is for real. But just, how these things come together, it really unlocked a ton. And this is, kind of skipping ahead to the boot camp event that we're putting together in October and that you and Crown and you Woodford are coming to. the ability to do that for other people. Although we realized after, you know, the benefit of me hitting myself in the face with a shoe is like, oh, we should have people sign waivers to do this, but that that people can come and do that. And I feel like it just unlocks so much in terms of, you know, what they grasp about what goes into this and, you know, what's worth what and the beauty behind it all. So like, I mean, I'm incredibly excited for that and to, you know, kind of have people, you know, line up to injure themselves.
There's a lot of people that make really nice shoes that sell them to really nice brands that sell them in the shop. And no one, you can see them in the shop. You go to a shop in London, there's lovely tailors and they go, this is what, yeah. But I want the light switch from the shop front to the guys that are actually making it, because that's much more important than the shop front in my mind. And so, yeah, that'd be cool. I'm doing the same. I want to send them all over the world. They're going to Japan next year in March, but they're coming to you in New York. And I want people just to get a feel for how kind of tactile and kind of like a craft it is, much more than is like perceived. Like machines exist because they wanted to sell more of this stuff because it's clearly working. And then over time, you get brands that slowly reduce the quality, but because they have to sell more and more at a certain price point. But hopefully, well, I'm definitely not ever selling it. And I've got no like issues with paying whatever it costs to get it where it needs to be seen. Because as soon as people see it, they get it. And that's what has the value. It's really difficult to explain. And without actually seeing it. But when people come here and they see people sewing a thread and hand stitching a welt onto it and hand channeling it and how long it takes. And
you know, part of my appreciation for all of it when we were over there, I mean, you mentioned it, like it's been 3 years and you're not even selling these things, right? It's just training and learning and this knowledge transfer. I think it was Will, it might've been Lewis, but you previously worked at Dr. Martin's, right? Which is shoes, right? Where you're making shoes and boots and all that, but completely different, you know? And the idea that one, that can happen, but two, you know, you think of, okay, I'm going to train to be this high-end, you know, handmade shoemaker, and you go to Italy, right? You take these courses and you figure out how to apprentice under somebody who, you know, is just kind of smacking you on the knuckles and saying, do that better. And even though it can take quite some time, I think that it's supposed to happen, you know, somewhat fast. I mean, you're paying for all this stuff, right? And I feel like you've flipped that, where you're creating this academy and you're paying people to learn, and it's somebody who is working in very much a factory setting and, you know, might not have had that opportunity on their own to say, I'm going to go to Italy, plunk down a bunch of cash and, you know, hope that I'm halfway decent at this. And I think that there's something just quite wonderful about that, that it's just completely reversed in terms of opportunity in a way.
So the wholesale paid for Crown, Northampton, the sneaker site and the wholesale paid for E. Woodford, which is taking a long time. And then when this is up and running, we're hoping that the academy over the road, we bought the building. We just want to kit it out so that we can train people to do this stuff. And you're right. Some people want to learn how to make shoes and they'll go and do a course, a crash course, and then go, I can make a shoe. But it just takes time. You just need to do the same thing over and over. But I want to be able to offer that to people that want a career in it where they can do loads of different jobs. And it's not like if I was trying to make a production line of handmade stuff, I'd have one guy who channels insoles and he'd be really good at it. And that's all he'd do all day. And he'd get really bored, but that's it. And then I'd have another guy pulling on uppers and that's all it. But it's not like this. I want all of them to know all of it. And that way they don't get bored. And that way they have a career. And that way, like, hopefully people will appreciate what they're doing. So one of the things we're doing when you buy a pair of our shoes, like this has taken ages to kind of work out. It's like one thing we don't want is returns. Like they don't fit returns. But so we've got, when you place an order, you get like you talked to Michael about this, but how to get proper fittings. And there's like a paper that you put your foot on that gives you an imprint of your foot, and that will come back to us. And then we'll send you a mock-up of the shoe that we think will fit you. And then when that's confirmed after 3 months, hopefully, maybe four, maybe five, depends how busy we are, you'll have a delivery date when you're placing an order. Basically, you're ordering slots of time from the handmakers because we can only make 25. When we've sold 25, it'll switch to another month's delivery date. If that makes sense. What we want someone that's buying the shoe is to experience, like, you know, you came here and you experienced something while you were here. Like you got it to see it happening. I want people to experience something amazing when they get the shoes and the whole process, and that we're really looking after them, and that there's little stitches they could change if they want to before their final shoe's made, and that as long as they're happy with the material choice they've made. There's loads that's gone into that side of it. So this really harps back to that no production line thing. There's a box, and in that box, there's a card, and in that card, it will say who hand-stitched the uppers, who hand-stitched, who channeled it, who put it on the last, and everything about your shoe. So if you ever want another shoe, you know who made it. You can request that person to make it. It's just a nice thing. Also, when your shoe's being made, we'll give you, like, you can it will be online, like, it will be videoed, literally, we'll book a slot of time that suits the customer, especially if you're in the States. We're going to have a lot of late nights here, I imagine, with hand welters. But I want people to, if they want to, see their shoe being lasted by the guy that's making their shoe, because they're paying a lot of money, but it makes it feel more genuine. You know, it's there's a lot of people that say they do nice stuff, and then you buy it and you get it in a really fancy box and go, how do I know that? You know what I mean? How do I know that's genuine? Whereas the doors are always open here, and I want that to be like as it is online as well. Like you can walk in and go, oh, right, this is like really happening. And I want that to be perceived even if you never come here. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, it's the guys we met, a couple genial gents. They were, I expected them to be, you know, far harsher and more disgusted by the work that we were accomplishing. They were very encouraging and quite patient. And, you know, like that's like a very much clearly, especially after this conversation, like a cultural thing that's happening there.
The fact when you're making like dress shoes, which these are sort of dress shoes, they're a little bit more casual, especially when I'm taking a suede and I'm putting a print on it, they're a little bit more casual, is that people think they're kind of, I don't know, especially in England, if you're buying shoes from a fifth generation factory in England, they must be very posh. You must wear the correct shoe for it. But that's not what I want. I want someone to go, that is really well bloody made. Like that's flipping amazing. How do I get it? And I can't get it anywhere else. And it takes ages, but it has to take ages. You know, it's a privilege for us to make it for someone because they're obviously ordering it, but it's a privilege for them to get it as well. That's the thing. That's what I want it to be like. I don't want it that pompous English thing. And that's society. That's where we have to change it a little bit, is that perception, I think, of what a handmade shoe is. Because that's normally like there's loads and loads of I've got a little bit addicted to watching Japanese handmade shoes, and they're so precise and they're cutting stuff. It's all very spot on, and it's all very like, this is the correct calf leather for this. But I'm like, well, let's just use the best leather and let's just make it, and there it is. Whereas they're specifically tailored for a certain market, whereas I just again haven't thought about the market. And I know you need to earn a bit of money to pay for this stuff, but I haven't got a demographic. Like it's not down to me to say who buys it. It could be someone that wants a pair to put on their wall as art, you know? It could be someone that wants to wear it for their wedding. It could be someone that wants to wear it every day and jump up and down in a puddle. As long as they're appreciating what it is and how they got it, why they got it, that's what matters, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think belief has carried you pretty far so far, right? Like just belief in the idea that somebody wants these products. And yeah, I mean, I'm excited to hopefully see it happen again. So we mentioned this bootcamp event. Crown and E. Woodford are coming. You're coming. People will be able to get their hands dirty. What else can people expect?
We're going to basically, this room I'm sat in is like, it's like our last room. There's like three lasting pins here. And the real, actually, you'll get this from time to time. The people that hand last shoes, that they're always normally sitting down with straps over their knees. And that's cool if that's the way you want to hand last stuff and hand make stuff. The lads that I've taught, they much prefer standing up at like these pins, like this thing here. So we're going to take these over. Basically, this room is going to New York. And the two lads will be there. I'll be there. And then there's some other people there. We don't need to know their names. But the most important ones are Lewis and Will. And they're going to be basically making some handmade shoes, and hopefully, health and safety permitting, people being allowed to have a go if they want to, but just have a chat about what we're doing and have a, like, pick up the shoes and hopefully understand why they're kind of unique. And yeah, so we've got a big old bench, a big old table of that, I hope. And then either side of that, you'll have a little range of R.E. Woodford shoes, and if anyone has any questions, I'm going to be there. So like, especially pattern specific or leather specific, or just like questions about life in general, cater for all. And then, there'll be a Crown Northampton signed as well, where we've got, so, Crown Northampton is all, made to order, but if it doesn't fit, we have them back. And those ones that we have back, or if they're a sample, for example, that we made, or if it's a fit trial that we did, or if it's a slight imperfection, we've put it in stock here. So we have got a load of stuff that we can sell at a discounted rate when we're there, like the sneakers. Or if you want to just get your fit right for the sneakers, we'll take a fit range as well. But it's kind of just, we just want people to talk about nice made stuff. I know you've got loads of other brands there that people will be interested in looking at going, oh, this is really nice made stuff. And that's kind of what it's about, isn't it? For you, I hope. But from what I've got from you, I really like what you're doing. Otherwise, you wouldn't be having these conversations. It's kind of working.
Yeah, I mean, this is my favorite thing to do. And, you know, getting people together with the people that I get to talk to all the time, anytime it happens, like on a smaller scale, you know, just one person who makes something and a bunch of people who love it. I mean, it's magic. It really is every time. So you just blow that the hell out.
Yeah, you're as mad as I am. That's what it comes down to. You're as mad as I am. That's probably why it works.
All right. Last one. Let's back it all the way out here. It remains difficult, I would say, to unseat Northampton as the most important quality shoemaking capital in a lot of ways, but it looks a lot different than it did 40 years ago. What do you think it looks like 40 years from now?
So in 40 years, what I see where I'm sat for me is probably, I don't know, 20 more brands. Different styles of shoes. Yeah, all trained at an academy. I want to see 200 people. I would employ 200 people, but I want them with job security and I want them in like trained to go into one of these next brands. So like after E. Woodford goes live, I've already got ideas for the next two different brands, but I've got to train people and get it all up and running. It's not tomorrow. Nothing's tomorrow. It's lovely not to borrow money to get it done. It's just nice that it's all kind of genuine and it's all kind of off the back of people getting what we're doing. It's kind of, just feels like I'm growing, and I'm growing because people are understanding what I'm doing, and it's just such a nice feeling to create jobs. And so I see ups and downs like all of Northampton. I see if someone, so if you're talking wholesale for shoe, like Brockett and Jones are in Northampton and they sell loads, and they will always sell loads because they do great things, like they make James Bond shoe, and that's a cool shoe, and they keep on top of stuff like that, and there is a place in the market for that. You have to keep designing new stuff. I've got kind of a bit of a gift of every time I design something or every time I create something, it's kind of done. So I move on. And if it gets, it just is what it is. Like, I can't change it. Like some people, I'm sure there'll be people that see what I've made and go, that's far too much money for something. It's not worth it. Or the styling's rubbish. That's just fine. That's just opinion. That's cool. But I've already moved on from that. Like it's the best I could possibly make. And I'm really proud of it. And I hope someone else is. And that's what drives, I think, people to buy stuff. And that's what drives the creation of jobs. So the people that are left in the industry is getting less and less from the wholesale perspective. But the people that are moving to this kind of stuff where I can, wouldn't that be nice? If you came back here in 5 years' time and there was 200 people making all sorts of stuff, you could really tell people this is like the best we can do at that. It's like the best of that. And that makes Northampton still cool.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in for that again, like the walking tour and, you know, what used to be, and it's not that anymore. Yeah. I mean, it stung a little bit. Right. And like, it was very visceral as you were walking around thinking of just what everything used to look like, whether it was 1930 or 1975, the idea that Crockett and Jones is going to manufacture somewhere else, or Trickers or Edward Green, you know, like, those are horrifying thoughts and nothing that I would ever want. But it's not, you know, 200 makers. It's about a dozen. The idea, you know, beyond that of some new brand starting a large scale factory welted operation in Northampton seems far fetched, right? Like the preservation of the ones that exist is crucial. But, you know, somebody's going to be making a couple hundred thousand pairs out of nowhere. I mean, the legacy and the history and the story behind those brands, I think, is what allows them to continue to do that, to have people want to work there and be a part of that, to have people want to buy shoes at a certain price because of, you know, what it represents and where it comes from. Building that back up in there in the States, it's tough, you know, like not terribly likely. But yeah, I mean, what you're talking about on, you know, a different scale with a different approach and something that, you know, I mean, it's going to cost, right? But if it's being made in this, you know, cradle of shoemaking and it's being done truly well and there is a personal experience involved in it, I mean, yeah, like my hope is that people do want to pay for that and that there is, you know, the interest from the people who, you know, live in that town that, you know, 80% of them used to be involved in shoemaking or materials creation or something like that. And I mean, that number is not even flipped, right? It's not 20% now.
No, it's less than, it's like 2%. Yeah.
Yeah. And but you're not going to push it back to 80%, but if you push it to 3% or 5%, that, I don't know, some amazing things could still happen there on whatever scale that is. You know, that's something that I'm certainly hoping for. And, you know, somebody's got to go do it, right? And somebody's got to see what that can look like. It's not going to just happen on its own because the business forces are all driving directly against it.
You could look at it two ways, really. Like, it only takes one person running a factory to go, actually, should we get them made in, I don't know, India or Portugal? Or because we can get them made a bit cheaper there. And as soon as you make that decision, as soon as the machinery goes and those people are unemployed, that's done. Yeah, it's done. But on the flip side of that, as soon as there's someone like me, I suppose, that makes the decision to always make here and show it and not actually do wholesale, just do direct to consumer and find a way of making it work, I think there's opportunity, but you just got to kind of, you do have to have a lot of faith. Like there are some days I'm like, what am I doing here? It's like, it's midnight and I'm hand cutting a shoe. This is like nuts. But it's if you have a passion for something, I suppose you just do it. I suppose you've got to hope that people have enough passion and enough ability and enough faith in what they're doing that it will continue. I suppose that's what Northampton needs. But it's quite difficult because there's a bit of a people from Northampton are an unusual breed. They're kind of, we're not. It's very difficult for me to sit and talk to you because it's not really in our nature. I want to be far away from the camera as I could possibly be, just making something just back there in the shed, you know, out the way. Don't talk about me. Oh God, that's normal. That's how we are. But I know without me doing this, it changes when you go, if I don't do things like this and if I don't shout about how good we are, then people aren't going to have jobs. So here I am, you know.
I'm sorry for putting you in front of a mic and a camera. We'll let you go.
That's it. So I'm getting used to it now.
apologies for contributing to that, but look, let's call it. That's it. We're letting you off the hook. Huge thanks to Grandstone for sponsoring this episode and having widths up to triple E in dozens of styles. Sign up for their newsletter for B grade releases and more at grandstoneshoes.com. And if you've decided that you like Chris, you know, a little bit, even after this episode, come see him, Crown Northampton, E. Woodford and Sons, at Stitchdown's Boot Camp this October in New York City, along with over a dozen other brands, quite literally from around the world, and free beer. We're going to have free beer too, so that's good. Check out stitchdownbootcamp.com.
That's the reason I did all this.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to love the beer, Chris. Look, most of all, thank you, Chris Woodford, for coming on, enduring all of this, and telling us what's going on there, shedding light on a ton of stuff, and like, frankly, like, very honestly, just doing what you're doing. I think it's wonderful.
Cool. Thank you. And I will carry on. I don't know anything else.
Perfect. Works out for everybody. That's it for this week. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.